Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, this is Tommy Tomlinson, and this is Southbound. We're going to start things a little different today. We've got a guest coming up in a minute, but throughout this episode, I'm going to tell a few stories about my life watching professional wrestling. So here's wrestling story number one. When I was a kid in South Georgia, every Saturday night, this was before cable, my dad would turn the little rotor that controlled the TV antenna attached to the back of our house. He aimed it north towards Savannah, because the Savannah station had Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling. For years and years, we watched it religiously. More than religiously, I guess, because we watched wrestling more than we went to church. The stars of the show were some of the greatest of all time. Dusty Rhodes, Ricky Steamboat, Wahoo McDaniel, Abdul the Butcher, Blackjack Mulligan, and most of all, the incomparable Ric Flair. My dad would get so mad when Ric Flair would come out and brag about his alligator shoes, then go in the ring and cheat to win. I secretly thought Ric Flair was pretty cool. My dad was not a big conversationalist. Even though we loved each other deeply, sometimes we had a hard time making small talk. But our whole time together, up until he died in 1990, wrestling was something we could always talk about. And I'll always be grateful for that. My guest today is somebody my dad and I saw every week on TV, David Crockett, who for years was one of the announcers for Mid-Atlantic Wrestling. He spent most of his working life in the wrestling business, in front of the camera and behind it, outside the ring and in. He was part of his family from the time he was born. Just like it was in mine. Here's our conversation. David Crockett, I was thinking that 20 or 30 years ago, we couldn't have really had this kind of conversation.
In what way?
Well, because there was this thing that in the wrestling business was called, I think, kayfabe is the right word.
We could have sort of a conversation.
Right.
Not in depth. How about that?
Right. And the idea was to preserve the illusion that wrestling was a sporting event, and that the faces and the heels, as they say, the good guys and the bad guys, really hated each other in real life, and they were kept separate outside the ring. Right?
Well, some of them did hate each other.
Well, okay.
And it's, to me, it was sports entertainment.
The question I'm getting to is, how did that affect sort of day-to-day life? How did you guys navigate? Could you be seen with one another? How'd you socialize? How'd you get from one place to another without, you know, breaking those rules?
We could be seen together, especially we could travel between, let's say, the good guys and the bad guys.
Right.
And it's strange, though, that with our production, we produced events up north, and people like Dusty Rhodes, you know, who was the huge baby face, he was a heel up there. The people just didn't like him. He was too good. So it depends on, and that fascinated me, depends on where you're living to who they like. You and I could be in the ring, and somebody's going to boo one of us, and somebody's going to cheer.
If we're doing our jobs right.
Right. Yeah. It's just personalities. In some cases, you would have the same restaurant. Let's say you're in Charlotte and we flew everybody in. Well, we're going to pick one hotel. So everybody's at that one hotel. And so you just sort of, you know, bad guys are at one end of the restaurant and the good guys are at the other end of the restaurant.
Right. And your family was involved in the business from way, way back, right?
Dad started in he incorporated in 1933.
And how did he get into it in the first place?
He started putting out posters. He grew up in Bristol, Tennessee, Virginia.
Sure.
And he started putting out posters for a boxing promoter. Ended up, he kept on and traveled with the promoter, putting posters up and helping, then he started managing a boxer and eventually came to the Carolinas and really wanted to live in Greensboro. At that time, though, Charlotte had the Boxing and Wrestling Commission, and one of the requirements was that you had to live in Mecklenburg County. So he moved to Charlotte.
So you were around when they first started doing TV shows.
Then. Yeah, I was a kid. I was a kid. I was screaming
so
and yelling.
Before that, it was
I was hating the bad guys. Let's put it that way. I hated the bad guys.
Right.
You know, Bolo was one of those that I hated.
Yeah.
Now, that was hard to do. Any masked wrestler, you know, how's he going to, you know, conceal his identity if he's driving off in the same vehicle? Well, you know, Dad took us one time, Bolo, he drove, I think they were going to Lexington after a TV show, and I was sitting in the back seat. Dad turned to me and said, David, what you see and hear from now on stays here, period. And that's all he said. It wasn't, okay, kayfabe, and, you know, this is just the way it is.
So you saw Bolo unmasked. Basically.
Yes.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, you stayed in the business, and I know for a little while, for a year or two there, you actually wrestled, right?
That I did. And I was an amateur wrestler. And what it was, Dad said, nobody in the family has ever been on the other end of it as far as the participant. And I wasn't married or anything. I said, okay, I'll try it. I got the hell beat out of me. I learned the psychology of wrestling, which is something that you cannot teach in a school. It's you have to listen to the audience, and then you have to take hold of the audience and manipulate them.
Explain a little bit what you're talking
about. All right. Good one, John Valentine.
Famous Johnny Valentine.
Yes.
Legendary star back in the 60s, 70s here.
He came in, and he was wrestling Johnny Weaver at Park Center. And he had Johnny in an arm bar, nothing else. And as Johnny would try to get up, he'd take him back down. Yeah, and it was such a boring thing, too. People started booing and yelling and screaming, and then you'd see Weaver start getting up a little bit, then Valentine. That's crowd psychology and not letting them have what they want. You do, but you don't. You know what I mean? He starts coming up, and that progressed. He did 20 minutes in an arm bar. And then it progressed to 60 minutes. And Valentine was not a high flyer or anything like that. And he was very believable. Valentine would take the audience, and he would take them where he wanted through the whole match. The bad guy is the leader, you know, in the match. And to watch them, they're the thinkers. They're listening to the audience, the Andersons, Gene and Ole Anderson. Perfect example, too, that Ole will be in and Gene will be on the outside of the ring and listening to the crowd. And sort of, and there again, they're not planning this whole match. We sort of know the end, but everything else in between, it's all ad-lib.
I think people who follow wrestling fairly closely sort of know that in general now, but I want to make sure for the people who aren't fans, when you go in, you see a regular match at even on TV now.
Right.
The participants kind of have the ending or an idea of what the ending might be like.
Well, I'm going to say the new ones, it's scripted all the way through.
Okay.
They have writers, you know, the WWE, they have writers that write this thing, you know, what you say. Your walk to the ring, in the ring, and there's not a lot of ad-libbing, let's say. Some of the better ones we'd give them an interview, and it would be, okay, you're going to be wrestling here in Charlotte Monday night, and you're going to be wrestling, and then they start. Right. And they can go, you know, we know we're going to go, let's say, 30 seconds or a minute. And it's amazing what came out of their mouths. They're aware of what's going on around them. Big readers, you know, I watch Rick and Bobby Heenan, Arn Anderson. They are reading magazines, newspapers, listening to the radio, picking up, and they will add in present day to even their interviews for the event.
After a couple of years of in the ring, you transitioned out, and did you go straight to being an announcer then, or
no? No, we had an announcer at the time that he and Bob Caudle was in Raleigh. He was our announcer up there, and he showed up drunk.
Not Bob, but the other guy.
Yes. So my brother Jimmy and I flipped a coin, and I lost. So I started announcing.
So what's the job of the announcer as part of the show? What did you see as your role?
Our role is to verbally make you feel like you're ringside, that you're front row.
I laughed later on once, you know, watched ever since I was a kid, and one of the moves that you guys had often is at the very end of a show, a big brawl would break out, mm-hmm. and you guys, then you would go, sorry, we're out of time.
Oh, I'd start laughing. Oh, yeah. I knew it was making people mad.
Well,
I knew it.
Well, and the funny thing was, as I got older, I figured out, wait a second, that's a tape show. They could end it anytime they wanted. You know, they're just cutting out to leave the
Midnight Express, Rock and Roll Express.
Right.
It was an hour. They were in Shelby, North Carolina.
Really?
They wrestled an hour, and Bob and I were hoarse.
And so you talked about what the wrestlers would know and not know going into a match.
Mm-hmm.
Would you, as the announcer, know anything that was going to happen?
No. I did not.
You paused there.
I paused because one time I did, and I actually said on air, that's not what's supposed to happen.
Oh, really?
Yes, and so I said, never ever tell me what's going to happen. I wanted to be a fan.
Right.
Out there, both Bob and I, we wanted to get excited. And if we knew what was, it's like reading the end of a book before you read the book.
Yeah, and so you reacted in the moment
right.
the same way that anybody else mm-hmm. would.
Correct.
I want to go back to ask about a couple of particular moments, but one that sort of happened in the middle of all this. You were involved in this big plane crash.
Yes.
That Ric Flair was in, Johnny Valentine, who you mentioned earlier,
Tim Woods,
who was known as
and
Mr.
Bob Ruggers.
Yeah. And that was a huge event. Not just in terms of people getting injured, but it basically ended Johnny Valentine's career, right?
And Bob Ruggers.
And Bob Ruggers, and affected Ric Flair.
Yes.
I think he broke his back or that sort of thing. What do you remember anything about that or sort of what that was like?
Very little. I had, believe it or not, my seat was the only seat that did not break loose. I had extensive head injuries. As my wife said, I was goofy for at least 6 months. Matter of fact, my first flight after that was from Charlotte to Raleigh just to see if I could stand being on a plane.
Because that was such a short hop.
Yeah, it was the longest flight I ever had. It really was. It was bumpy. The flight attendant came by and said, are you sick? Anything I can help? My brother Jimmy was behind me. He said, no, this is his first flight after a plane crash. And I was white-knuckled. Even to this day, I know if something's wrong with the plane. When it starts off, smell, sounds, you name it, I'll perk up, and I'll start asking questions.
So who were some of your favorite people to work with during that time? People that you feel like you had a good rapport with or that, you know, that were just fun to be around or whatever?
Ric Flair.
How so?
I remember when he first came. He really wanted to be Ramblin' Rickus Rhodes after Dusty. But
I never heard that
yeah,
one.
Yeah, but the Andersons sort of brought him in and said, you know, it could be one of ours. And
right, that's how he came in as sort of a cousin to the Anderson family, right?
And the way he got educated, he wrestled all the top wrestlers. And Gene and Ole sort of helped him along, especially Gene, in that Gene was one of those people that if you did something wrong, he physically let you know it. Terry Allen.
Magnum TA.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and it was a shame that, you know, what happened to him.
Dusty,
you know, he was the one that sort of put us on a rocket, you might say, in his creativity.
I wanted to ask, is there somebody in particular, maybe that's the guy, who was seen as like super bad guy, really vicious in the ring, but in real life was like super sweet and like
both Ole and Gene. Right. Ole and Gene Anderson were pussycats. You know, and the thing is too, people would yell and scream and throw things, get in the ring with them. Outside, they're the first ones who want the autograph from them. But, you know, outside the ring, away from the ring, they were very nice. Very nice.
Hey, this is Tommy. If you'd like to be a part of the Southbound community, we'd love to hear from you. You can suggest ideas for future guests on our homepage at wfae.org/southbound. You can also reach me directly at ttomlinson@wfae.org or tweet at me at Tommy Tomlinson. What really helps is if you leave us a good rating and review on the Apple Podcasts or the NPR One app. That helps Southbound get out there to even more listeners. Thanks for all your support.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Now, here's wrestling story number two. Sometime in the 90s, I was driving through Rock Hill, South Carolina, and pulled over at a service station to get gas. As the tank was filling up, a blue Cadillac rolled into the next row over. The man who got out was Ivan Koloff. Ivan the Russian Bear Koloff. One of the most dastardly wrestlers of all time. He always came to the ring with a chain wrapped around his neck. They called it a Russian chain. And even though it looked like a regular chain, when I was a kid, I figured it was made out of Siberian steel or something. We both finished pumping gas about the same time, and he walked into the station ahead of me. Years later, I would read up on Ivan Koloff and find out that in real life, he was more of a teddy bear than anything. After wrestling, he became a minister and was known for officiating weddings. But at the time, I didn't know that. At the gas station counter, he paid with a credit card, and I got as close behind him as I could so I could peer over his shoulder. I really wanted to know if it said Ivan Koloff on his Visa card. But I couldn't see. And when he turned to leave, I gave him plenty of room. Best not to mess with the Russian bear. And now, back to our conversation with David Crockett. Well, he talked about getting in the ring. I want to ask about one of the things that I remember very much from growing up was the sort of a storyline that involved you getting clotheslined by Nikita Koloff.
He had so much fun doing that.
Yeah, well, let me set that up real quick. Ivan Koloff was a longtime bad guy.
Yes.
His nephew, quote-unquote, Nikita, came in, who is even bigger and stronger and angrier than Ivan. They're terrorizing the Mid-Atlantic territory.
Yes.
And then what – you kind of take it from there, what happened that particular time?
I was asked if I would mind taking a shot from Nikita. You got to be kidding here.
Nikita,
from Nikita? Nikita was known by wrestlers as not being the softest touch, you might say. Yeah, he was very tight. And I went, ooh. I went, okay. And I knew it was going to happen, but I didn't know when. And Nikita said he relished that moment. And if you think about it, it's like pitch black dark. You're running, and all of a sudden you run into a clothesline. And he hit me, and I went down. I had no choice.
So you knew that was coming. You just didn't know when during the interview.
No idea.
And so did you have a second? Could you sense that he was getting ready to do it?
Oh, the gleam in his eyes. he was just looking to say that grin on his face. And
And that led to the what many of us who grew up watching this remember as his famous Great American Bash.
Right.
Here in Charlotte at the Memorial Stadium, mm-hmm. the football stadium, where they brought Ric Flair in a helicopter.
Yes.
To wrestle Nikita, and you were the guest referee.
Yes.
Now, you talked about the roles of the wrestlers in the match. You talked mm-hmm. about the role of the announcer in presenting the show. What does the referee do?
The referee is a part of the show. One thing is supposed to stay out of the way.
Right.
They will basically tell me what to do in the ring. And
you mean the referees?
No, the wrestlers. In a way, and it might be a look, might be a word. It was really strange. You know, I felt like a duck out of water, but it was exciting at the same time to watch these professionals. In that, I would go over. They'd stay in a corner too long. I knew that I was supposed to count, and if they stayed too long, I knew I was supposed to get in there and try to break it up. Because you're not going to count them out. So you know that, and I know that if they went outside the ring, I'm not going to count them out. I had to figure out some way to either go out of the ring and try to get them back in, or if it was a tag team, let's say Ivan would come in and start arguing with me so I wouldn't count him out, and vice versa, or the baby face with Rick. And that's how that was done.
And the other thing I remember from that match is that you talked about fans. So there was a fan who did jump in.
Yes.
At some point. And that was not...
No.
That was an unscripted fan.
Right. And the thing is, when they jump in and all of a sudden realize where they are, true panic. You're not supposed to hurt them, but you also have to subdue them.
Now, have you had times where you felt like things are getting a little too hot? I mean, where you felt like people might have been in danger, the wrestlers, or any of that sort of thing?
In danger of the wrestlers? It has happened in that it's a total surprise. Ole Anderson in Greenville, South Carolina, as he was walking back to the dressing room, a man had a hawk-billed hunting knife and cut him right across his chest. Well, all he remembers is that he took that hand and whatever was on the other end of it just beat it to a pulp. But he had to go and have quite a few, I don't know how many stitches across his chest. You can tell when an audience might all at once go crazy, it's when it gets real silent.
Really?
Oh, yes. It's you can hear a pin drop.
And do you remember one of those moments?
Yes, when Bob Roop, who was a wrestler, amateur wrestler, Greco-Roman, and then turned heel, they got silent, and they started after him, and the police, we stopped them, scared him so much, he didn't even bother getting in his clothes. He just got his keys and ran out and got in his car. We never saw him again. You know, as a true baby face, he wasn't ready to be a heel. That's what happened.
Wow. So one of the things that I think has, you know, come to light for even casual fans over the years is how sort of legendary the parties were on these trips. You know, there's...
You're talking about Ric Flair.
I am talking mostly about Ric
Flair.
Yes,
you are. Yes, you are. He would advertise them.
Well, and so tell me what that, what being part of that circuit was like.
To be the man, you got to beat the man. They called him, what, the 60-minute man? The Four Horsemen, their parties were legendary. They wanted people to come, you know, whether it was, let's say, the Omni in Norfolk or the Marriott in Richmond, wherever it is, they would say, we're going to be there and we're going to have a party, and they did. Rick's normal bar tab in a lounge would be close to $1,000. You know,
in the 70s and 80s.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just buying liquor. Yeah. He and Roddy Piper, some of the police that were at the wrestling match as our security, we sort of paid them to go with them to try to keep them out of trouble. Because in these bars, some people, you know, when you drink, you think that you can beat anybody, so to speak, as far as the fan. And some guys wanted to impress their girlfriend, and their, you know, because their girlfriend really wanted to go over and meet these guys and party with them, and that wasn't a good thing.
I wondered about, especially in the days when Mid-Atlantic was such a kind of hot thing, would you get recognized a lot?
Like, yes.
In towns and down the street?
Yes.
And what was that like?
I enjoyed it. I guess, you know, it was nice that it showed me people were watching. The only thing I asked is when I was with my family that if we were eating, if they minded wait until we finished, then I'd be more than happy to sign their autograph, take a picture, anything like that.
You right.
know, there are certain rules of etiquette, I guess you might say, that I asked for.
I always wonder if people wanted to tell you to, like, see if you can stop that Ric Flair. You know,
oh, yeah.
You know what
yeah.
I mean? If they
especially
like
especially the grandmothers and you know, the younger people just wanted an autograph. The older people would give me a lecture.
Yeah. So I guess in like the late 80s, you guys sold the company to Ted Turner, right?
Yes.
And did you keep working after that? Or
I did up to a point. I was vice president of television production, and I was told that it will never be a Turner program as long as the Crockett is on air, which is true. So that was fine. It wasn't my life to be an announcer. I wanted to be behind the camera, which, you know, I was doing that for quite a while. Before the sale. Matter of fact, we created our own television production group.
I guess I want to back up here just a bit. Mid-Atlantic, Jim Crockett Promotions mm-hmm. was part of, back in the days, all these different territories that covered different regions of the country and different alliances. And there was sort of a gentleman's agreement to, by and large,
yes.
not to bleed over from
right.
one to the other. And now, basically, all that's gone.
Yes.
That Vince McMahon and WWE own... They're over the top of everything. There are smaller companies underneath that are trying to get a foothold, but they're basically the one global, one at least in this country.
Right.
And I just wanted to ask sort of how you feel about how all that has played out over the years.
Well, I think that Vince, when he bought WCW from Turner, made the mistake of not keeping the brand and have two separate competing, let's say, organizations. Now there is an AEW,
right,
which is Cody Rhodes, Dusty's son. They're also going to start in October on TNT with weekly television shows.
Right.
They're collecting their talent from the independents and also from Vince. So it'll be interesting to watch it.
Do you watch wrestling now?
A little. I don't watch a full program. Raw is going to have the reunion.
Yeah.
A lot of the guys that, you know, that I worked with, rode down the road with, are going to be on it. So I'll probably watch that.
You spent so much time in that business. Pro wrestling has been around for over 100 years.
And it'll still go. You have all these indies that are out there now.
Right. There's all these tendrils. It's a global thing. It's all over the world.
Yes.
What about it is so compelling? What keeps people coming back?
Good and evil. And evil will never, ever triumph over good. You might think it, but it won't. People just like to watch it. It's a release. You know, there was a gentleman that came to Park Center every Monday, and he said, after Park Center, he would go home and sleep, and it's the best night sleep he had all week, just because he released all that tension, you know, screaming and yelling. You know, he just put his mind in neutral when he got to the wrestling and just let it take him.
Here's wrestling story number 3. When I was doing research for this episode, I went on YouTube and looked up David Crockett. That led me to a bunch of old clips of Mid-Atlantic Wrestling, which led me to other clips from Florida Championship Wrestling and Georgia Championship Wrestling and some of the other shows my dad and I used to watch. Pretty soon, I was way down the rabbit hole. I watched for hours. I saw Ric Flair turn from bad guy to good guy to bad guy again. I watched Dusty Rhodes give his famous promo about living in hard times. And along the way, there were a couple of moments where, I'm not going to lie, I was wiping away tears. I never feel less cool than when I talk about why I love pro wrestling. Part of it is something about the stories wrestlers tell, both with their voices and their bodies. Part of it's something about seeing the same characters grow and change over 15 or 20 or 25 years. Part of it's something about the moment when the storyline finally pays off, and all those hours of watching feel like time well spent. But mostly for me, it's about bringing my dad back to life. When I was talking to David Crockett for this episode, it's like I was back in my living room in Georgia, and my dad was turning that rotor that worked the antenna, and we were about to spend an hour together. And an hour with somebody you love is everything. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Delacanal. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where we have show notes for each episode with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.